This is Audible.
Brick by Brick Audiobooks presents Dreamer of Dune, the biography of Frank Herbert by Brian Herbert. Read for you by Scott Brick. With love and appreciation, this book is for my darling Jan, who has given so much to me. For my mother, Beverly Stewart Herbert, for her devotion and her sacrifices. And for my father, Frank Herbert, who did so much for my mother in her time of need. This book is also for my sister Penny, her husband Ron, and my brother Bruce, and for Julie, Kim, Margot, David, Byron, and Robert, the grandchildren of Frank and Beverly Herbert. Introduction. How do we approach the study of Muad'Dib's father, Frank Herbert, in Dune? Joseph Campbell said the search for one's father is a major hero quest, equivalent to Telemachus seeking Odysseus. Frank Herbert was not always a heroic figure to me, for I did not get along well with him in my childhood, and only grew close to him when we were both adults. My attempt to understand him became an odyssey that went on not only during his lifetime, but afterward. It continues to this day, as I learn new things about him each time I read one of his stories, and each time I speak with someone who knew him and saw a different aspect of him than I did. He was a man of many facets, of countless passageways that ran through an intricate mind. His life was not linear. It proceeded in 50 directions at once. He was a man of surprises. My father once said to me, with a twinkle in his eye, that he had trouble using dictionaries and encyclopedias, since he so often became distracted by information on the opposite page, and this slowed him down. He had a boyish curiosity about everything, and a remarkable memory for detail. Dune is a reflection of this, a magnum opus that stands as one of the most complex, multi-layered novels ever written. So many questions come in from fans about my father. They want to know what he was working on late in his life, what his influence was on my writing, and more about his relationship with my mother. There are even current letters addressed to him, since they see wide arrays of his books in stores and think he's alive. In a very real sense, he is still with us, of course, in the magnificent literary legacy he left for his readers. He had a fascinating, phenomenal career, and this stands out above all else. He could not have done it without my mother, who sacrificed her own career as a creative writer in order to work and support our family during difficult times. I know there can be no greater love story than that of my remarkable parents. They trapped time and kept it for themselves in brilliant little time gems, cosmic and eternal. Frank and Beverly Herbert were significant and interesting people, rare in their abilities to leave lasting memories upon everyone coming in contact with them. I was one of those people. Brian Herbert, Seattle, Washington. Book 1, Pearl of Great Price. Chapter 1, Adventures in Darkest Africa. Frank Herbert's paternal grandfather, Otto, was born in 1864 on a boat while coming to America from Bavaria with other immigrants. As a young man, Otto met Mary Ellen Stanley, an illiterate Kentucky hill woman. By the turn of the century, the couple was living in Cairo, Illinois, with 5 sons. The surname, Herbert, was not adopted until Otto's parents entered the United States. The original family name has been lost. Otto worked as a solicitor for a steam laundry there and subsequently on the line in a bottling works. A restless, energetic man, he began attending meetings sponsored by the Social Democracy of America. This was a socialist group, founded and led by Eugene V. Debs. The SDA had a plan to colonize certain Western states, including the state of Washington, in order to dominate the politics of those regions. Eventually, they hoped to alter the moral and economic order of the entire country. But the colonization idea was steeped in controversy, and socialist leaders, including Debs himself, came to feel that it was not the most efficient utilization of people and assets on behalf of the socialist cause. Political action in cities and mill towns would produce better results, they thought. Still, Burley Colony in Washington State was founded in 1898 by the Cooperative Brotherhood, an SDA splinter group that pushed forward with the colonization plan. Burley Colony was on Burley Lagoon at the head of Henderson Bay, just north of Tacoma. This was a shallow lagoon where whales were sometimes trapped when the tide went out. The colonists were idealistic, advocating universal brotherhood, equal pay for all jobs, and equal rights for women. They had mottos like, "Make way for brotherhood," "Make way for man," and "Do your best and be kind." They liked to say ours instead of mine, and we instead of I. Each colonist received broad medical insurance. At its zenith, Burley was headquarters for an organization having 1,200 members all over the world, only a minority of whom actually lived in the commune. There were affiliated temples of the Knights of Brotherhood all over the United States, including facilities in Seattle, Tacoma, Fairhaven, Washington, Portland, Oregon, San Francisco, Reno, and Chicago. Contributions came in from powerful social organizations in Chicago, New York City, and Rochester. It was a short-lived colony, an experiment in socialist utopia that would last only a decade and a half. But at its height, the colony had a large church, community hall, library, schoolhouse, post office, sawmill, shingle mill, hotel and dining hall, general store, blacksmith's shop, dairy, laundry, and many other mercantile businesses. They printed a socialist newspaper and colony currency in the form of coupons good for purchases at commune businesses. They had factories for the preserving of ketchup and pickles, and a cigar factory, the largest in Washington State. The cigar factory produced marine cigars, selling for 3 to 6 cents apiece. They were excellent and popular, made of fine Kentucky Burley tobacco, imported to the colony. Hence the colony's name, Burley. Cigar boxes and labels were produced locally as well. Today the town of Burley, with only a few houses, a general store, a community hall, and a post office, is but a shadow of its former self. Most of the buildings, including the mills, the hotel, and the cigar factory, are long gone. Many houses, built without concrete foundations, have decayed into the ground. In 1905, Otto and Mary, now with 6 sons, and Otto's younger brother Frank, took a train from Illinois across the Great Northern Route to Washington State, and thence through recently opened Stampede Pass to Tacoma. From Tacoma, it was a short steamboat ride across the Narrows to Gig Harbor, followed by a 6-mile trip by horse-drawn stage to the colony through thick virgin forests. Otto and his brother each took a small government land grant just outside of Burley and set about making themselves part of the community. With his brother's assistance, Otto built a 2-story log house, and ultimately the Herberts bought property inside Burley itself, land that curved around the lagoon. Burley, called Circle City by locals because of the arrangement of buildings in a half-circle around an artesian well, had undergone a dramatic economic change shortly before the arrival of the Herberts. Through an amendment to the Articles of Incorporation of the colony, private ownership of land and industry was permitted. The Brotherhood remained in control, with profits going in equal shares to members. But this was no longer the socialist utopia originally envisioned by its founders. It was a curious amalgam of socialism and capitalism, and would last only 8 more years before falling apart entirely. But even with the departure of the Brotherhood in 1913, a community remained, with many former co-op members staying in the area. The land of this valley was dark and fertile, excellent for farming. Other former co-op members logged, operated dairies, and raised poultry. For many years, Burley remained the center of intellectual and social activity for the county. There were three Frank Herberts in my family. The first, Otto's brother, eventually gave up his land near Burley and went on the circus and vaudeville circuit as Professor Herbert, becoming a well-known performer of strongman feats, gymnastics, and daredevil acts. The next Frank Herbert, known as F.H. in ensuing years, was Otto's third son, born in December 1893 in Ballard County, Kentucky. F.H. in turn had a son, Frank Jr., who would become my father and one of the world's best-known authors. In Burley, Otto, Mary, and their children prospered and increased family real estate holdings. For many years, Otto operated a general store, Herbert's Store. The establishment carried, in the words of an old-timer, everything from tires to toothpicks. It had hay, grain, cow feed, chicken feed, clothing, medicines, dishes, hardware, and most everything else imaginable, piled high to the ceiling. It was not a greengrocery, as it sold no fresh produce. The locals grew their own vegetables and fruit and canned them. Credit slips hung on the wall behind the cash register. Otto's sons worked with him in the store, and when they grew up, they formed Herbert Brothers, which operated the family store, a gas station, an auto and electrical repair shop, a stage line, and a logging business. A stern, stocky little man, Otto was the undisputed ruler of his household. He named all six of his sons, and it is said that he did so without input from Mary. The boys were raised with stern German discipline, as my father called it later, the same sort of attention he would in turn receive from his father. At 7:30 in the morning on October 8th, 1920, Frank Herbert Jr. was born at St. Joseph Hospital in Tacoma. It was his mother's 19th birthday, and he would often joke in later years that he never forgot her birthday. F.H. and his wife Eileen were living in Tacoma at the time of their son's birth, but at every opportunity they visited Burley and the extended family there. Fond memories were formed in this little town on a lagoon, and these halcyon times would have a lasting impact upon young Frank Herbert. At the time of Frank's birth, his father was operating an auto bus line between Tacoma and Aberdeen to the south, an offshoot of the family's successful stage line that ran between Burley and Gig Harbor. The business became unprofitable, however, and by 1923, F.H. was working in Tacoma as an electrical equipment salesman. A stint as an automobile salesman followed. Then he became a motorcycle patrolman for the recently created Washington State Patrol. He had the Mount Rainier beat from East Pierce County to the base of the mountain. He was paid $30 a week. By 1925, family trips to Burley became easier. A modern car ferry transported them from Tacoma to Gig Harbor, and from there they drove to Burley on a fine new highway for motor vehicles. Frank's mother, Eileen Marie Babe Herbert, was a McCarthy. She was one of 13 children, most of whom were girls. They were beautiful, red-haired Irish Colleens, my father would tell me many years later. Babe's grandfather, the eldest son of an eldest son, was in a direct Irish royal line of succession that could have given him Blarney Castle in County Cork, which they called Castle McCarthy. But under British rule, such a lineage became meaningless to Babe's great-grandfather. He was an Irish Catholic rebel operating in County Cork and elsewhere in the mid-19th century. The rebels made an attempt to overthrow British rule, but police action crushed the insurrection. The McCarthys fled their homes in Ireland, just ahead of pursuing British authorities. The family went to Canada, and then to Wisconsin in the United States, where Babe was born. Her father, John A. McCarthy, was a mining engineer. In The White Plague, a novel published by my father many years later, he wrote about one of the stories his maternal grandfather, John A. McCarthy, used to tell at the dinner table. Here is the passage from the book, with actual names substituted for fictional ones. All of this for 700 rifles. That had been the McCarthy family plaint during the poor times. Frank had never lost the memory of Grandpa John's voice regretting the flight from Ireland. It was a story told and retold until it could be called up in total recall. The McCarthy silver, buried to keep it from piratical English tax collectors, had been dug up to finance the purchase of 700 rifles for a rising. In the aftermath of defeat, Grandpa John's father, a price on his head, had spirited the family to Canada under an assumed name. They had not resumed the McCarthy name until they were safely into the United States, well away from the thieving British. Frank Herbert's earliest memory went back to 1921, when he was around a year old. He was at his grandmother Mary's house in Burleigh, and he recalled walking straight under a wooden dining room table, covered with a white tablecloth. In May 1923, at the age of 2½, he was attacked by a vicious Malamute dog, an assault that nearly blinded him and left him with a lifetime scar over his right eye, just above the lid and extending into the eyebrow. His life was saved only because the dog knocked him beyond the reach of its chain. The terrifying image of the Malamute's ferocious mouth, filled with sharp teeth, remained with my father for the rest of his life, and he had difficulty overcoming an acute fear of aggressive dogs. When Frank was 5, his uncle Aid, Adrian McCarthy, who was a hunter, gave him a beagle puppy, which Dad took an instant liking to and named Bub. It was not a large dog, certainly not ferocious, and his uncle told him it would help him in the hunting of rabbits one day when the boy was big enough to handle a rifle. On a Tacoma beach one day, Dad and his father were digging clams.
This time they were using shovels. On other occasions, young Frank dug for gooey ducks, large burrowing clams with a crowbar, which he could use to get under the creature more quickly and pop it out of the sand.
Bub put his face down by a hole, and a clam spat stinging salt water in his eye. The dog yelped, and in a frenzy dug the offender out of the sand. Thereafter, Bub always growled at spitting clams and dug them up for the boy. Young Frank thought it uproariously funny. For years, he referred to Bub as the dog who hated clams, and eventually wrote about him in Chapter House Doom. My father had an early fascination with books and could read much of the newspaper before he was 5. He learned everything around him quickly, had an excellent memory and a long attention span. His number skills came to him early, and he loved puzzles. Everything interested him. At the age of 10, he saved enough money to buy a Kodak box camera with a flash attachment. He began taking pictures of family events that often involved hiking, sailing, or fishing. In his early teens, he purchased one of the new-fangled folding cameras, and shortly after color film was introduced in the mid-1930s, he purchased a miniature camera and began developing his own film. He set up a darkroom in the basement of his parents' home. Photography would remain a lifelong love for him. He was, without question, a gifted child. When a school tested his IQ, he claimed it was 190, well into the genius range. He would often say in later years, however, that IQ tests were not accurate in measuring intelligence. They were, in his opinion, heavily weighted toward language skills. Frank Herbert often spoke with fondness of the extended family in which he lived as a child, of time spent at the homes of aunts, uncles, and grandparents in Tacoma and Burleigh. His father had 4 brothers living in the area, and his mother had 8 sisters and 2 brothers nearby. So young Frank had many cousins with whom he could play, and if he happened to be over at a relative's house at dinner time, the aunt or uncle would phone home and say young Frank was staying for the meal, and often that he was going to spend the night. His Irish Catholic maternal aunts, who attempted to force religion on him, became the models for the Bene Gesserit Sisterhood of Doon. It is no accident that the pronunciations of Gesserit and Jesuit are similar, as he envisioned his maternal aunts and the Bene Gesserit of Doon as female Jesuits. The attempted brainwashing by his aunts, as he later termed it, was performed over the protestations of F.H., who was an agnostic. Before giving up the fight, F.H. had many arguments with Babe over this. In the end, The boy's religious beliefs became more like those of his father's than those of any other adult he knew. It would be impossible, perhaps, to categorize Frank Herbert's religious beliefs. He ascribed to no single organized belief system, but instead drew from many. He was attracted to Zen Buddhism in particular, as can be seen in his classic novel Dune, where there are wordless truths and Zen Sunni and Zen Sufi belief systems. Though he would not study Zen in detail until he met Alan Watts in the 1960s, he was exposed to it in his childhood. For a time, he had Nisei friends, second-generation Japanese who were born and educated in the United States. Some of them held Zen Buddhist beliefs. He also knew Coast Salish Indians and would come to know and respect their religious beliefs. This worldview would become central to his only non-science fiction novel, Soul Catcher, 1972. At a time before television, the children, particularly Frank, became adept at imagining adventures and frightening tales. In the evening around the fire at Scout Camp, everyone came to count on young Frank to come up with a scary story. Typically, a boy or a counselor would call out a blood and guts idea, such as blood in the well or a screaming eyeball from hell, and my father would fill in details to create a story around it. He never failed to entertain. In darkened bedrooms with his cousins, where mattresses and sleeping bags were thrown on the floor, he would do the same. His stories were filled with fright, adventure, voice alterations, and sound effects, and frequently involved ghosts, the Old West, and the sea. In 1928, while still on the state patrol, F.H. moved his family to Burley, where they maintained a small subsistence farm for the production of family foodstuffs, with a cow, chickens, and pigs. Bub, the dog who hated clams, accompanied them. They had a large vegetable garden with corn, peas, beans, carrots, lettuce, and other crops. Young Frank, now 7, had chores to do, and he accepted responsibility for them. Regularly rising in the frosty time before dawn, he milked the cow, collected eggs, and fed the pigs. Sometimes the farm animals were treated as pets, and the boy named them. He stopped doing that, however, when a favored chicken ended up on the chopping block. "Never name your dinner," his mother told him one day. He was in the 4-H Club and participated in a number of county fairs held in Burley. In one 4-H project, he raised and canned 500 chickens by himself. Children in town didn't have to go to school on their birthdays. In October 1928, on the morning of his 8th birthday, Frank Herbert went downstairs to a breakfast of sourdough flapjacks and real maple syrup, favorites of his that had been prepared specially for him by his mother and paternal grandmother. After the breakfast dishes were cleared away, he climbed on top of the table and announced to his family, in a very determined tone, "I want to be an author." That morning, he wrote his first short story, entitled Adventures in Darkest Africa, which he read to his family. Crayon drawings accompanied it. A jungle tale that began with a pretty good narrative hook to get the reader's interest, it involved an interesting character who had to surmount obstacles and find his way back to camp. The jungle, though described with childish inaccuracy, was nonetheless a threatening, problem-filled environment. Young Frank had been on a number of hunting and camping trips with his father and uncles in the forests of Washington State, and this story was an extrapolation based upon what he had learned about not getting lost in the woods. He had never been to Africa, except in imagination. Being the son of a police officer, he had heard adventurous tales of law enforcement. These were frequent topics of conversation at the dinner table, especially when police friends came to visit. The adults told of the time Babe helped arrest a drunken soldier, and of speakeasy raids she went on with F.H. One time an arrested man committed suicide in front of F.H. There were wanted criminals, fugitive chases, and police manhunts. Such material found its way into Frank Herbert's early stories. Soon he was using soft lead pencils to scrawl his stories on lined sheets of newsprint and in notebooks, illustrating many of them in crayon. He misspelled a number of words rather badly, and his handwriting wasn't too steady, but the tales and drawings were colorful and imaginative. With steady work, his stories improved, and he had them piled all over his room. His mother, obsessed with keeping order in a small wood frame house, was forever making neat piles. In a safe place, she put away stories and drawings that she particularly liked, and kept them for the rest of her life. From an early age, Frank Herbert was fastidious about his teeth, spending as much as 15 minutes at a time brushing them. In his entire lifetime, he never had one cavity, and his teeth were so perfect that dentists marveled upon seeing them. His father, F.H., was an expert fly fisherman and a knowledgeable all-around outdoorsman. Frequently, he took his son on trips into the woods, out in small boats or climbing on the beaches of Henderson Bay. Young Frank especially liked to fish in Burley Creek, which was loaded with brook trout. In the fall, salmon were so plentiful that they could be caught with bare hands. There were many smokehouses in the area, some dating back to the days of Burley Colony. It was a picturesque creek, winding through a forest of cedar, alder, and maple, and falling across a sequence of rocky beaches, emptying ultimately into Burley Lagoon. Often the boy went out on the salt water of Puget Sound and fished from a rowboat. On some fishing trips with his best friend, Dan Lodholm, they rode bicycles to nearby lakes where they fished for bass, using an unusual method taught to them by their elders. A fake mouse was secured to the fishing line, and with a short cast, this mouse was plopped under the top of a lily pad. Bass could be seen swimming under the lily pads, and when one came close, the boy would pull the line a little, toppling the mouse into the water. Every time Frank went fishing, he tossed a book in his Boy Scout pack, which he carried with him everywhere. He loved to read Rover Boy's adventures, as well as the stories of H.G. Wells, Jules Verne, and the science fiction of Edgar Rice Burroughs. His maternal grandfather, John McCarthy, after observing that the boy was always reading, said of him, "It's frightening. A kid that small shouldn't be so smart." The boy was not unlike Aaliyah in Dune, a person having adult comprehension in a child's body, with childlike emotions. These were formative days for my father, when the seeds of literary ideas were germinating. Throughout his career as a writer, he would continually call upon boyhood experiences. In the late 1920s, Burley was a place where gossip traveled fast. It was a curtain-twitching town, my father would recall. Someone looked out every time you passed a window. A colorful local, logger Bill Nirbon and F.H., frequently took young Frank on hunting and camping trips. The boy's uncles, maternal and paternal, also took him hunting, particularly Uncle Ade McCarthy, one of Babe's brothers, and Uncle Marley Herbert, one of F.H.'s brothers. One afternoon, F.H. and another of young Frank's uncles, Jack McCarthy, staged a convincing fight in a ditch in the middle of Burley. The whole town came to watch as the men wrestled, tore their shirts, and threw fists. The fight went on for the better part of an hour and matched any scene in Hollywood annals, with theatrics, but no real injuries. Presently, F.H. and Jack put their arms around one another, tucked in their tattered shirts, and walked off, saying, "That'll give 'em something to talk about." After that, several people in town refused to speak to the Herberts or McCarthys ever again. F.H. and Babe were on-again, off-again alcoholics during my father's childhood, consuming large quantities of whiskey. When his parents were on binges, the boy was too ashamed and embarrassed to bring his friends home, so he spent much of his time away from the house, fishing, hunting, and hiking. To a large degree, he grew up on his own and became independent at an early age. Young Frank became something of a provider for the family, as he brought home trout, salmon, crabs, clams, rabbits, and grouse for the supper table. His mother, though she had a problem with alcohol, was a wonderful cook. Above all outdoor pursuits, Frank was a fisherman. When he didn't have to go to school, he was often up before dawn, and off he would go with his fishing gear to a favored spot or to a new one he hadn't yet tried. Sometimes he took his gear to school so that he wouldn't have to go directly home after classes. He smoked much of the salmon he caught and took it to school for lunch, along with fruits, vegetables, and hard-boiled eggs from the family farm. The young man, despite his time spent outdoors, didn't tan readily, and his skin was pale. Some adults were concerned about his health. He had one bout with pneumonia, but overall was a tough, wiry kid, with tremendous arm and leg strength. These physical attributes made him a powerful swimmer at an early age. In 1929, the Washington State Patrol assigned F.H. to the highway between Gig Harbor and Bremerton. A big Harley-Davidson motorcycle was a common sight parked in front of the Herbert House. In those days, patrolmen wore forest green uniforms with black pocket flaps and black trouser stripes. The hats were military cap style, and the men wore puffy fascist trousers and high black boots. F.H. was quite a daredevil. Sometimes he turned off his motorcycle lights at night and roared up behind speeding cars, then flashed on his lights and pulled them over. F.H. also took his son into the backcountry with camping and hunting gear on the Harley, a practice that would never be permitted today. F.H. wore a Sam Brown belt with a .38-caliber Colt police-positive revolver holstered to it, and the boy sat behind him, holding on to the back of the wide belt. On one occasion, they went to Sunrise Lake, up a long dirt road. They stopped to make camp, and as F.H. was setting the kickstand of his bike, he spied a blue grouse seated on a low pine bough. With a fluid movement, he drew the big Colt revolver, took aim, and fired. The grouse was peppered with pine needles, but did not move. In a frenzy, F.H. emptied his revolver at the bird, missing every shot. The bird stared back at him. Frustrated, F.H. reloaded and moved closer. He fired again, but only knocked the branch out from under the bird. It flew away, eluding another hail of bullets. Eventually, F.H. became quite a marksman, moving up to captain of the patrol's drill team. A banquet was held in the state capitol at Olympia one year, at which he was slated to receive a Distinguished Conduct Award. Frank attended, and just before his father went on, he told the master of ceremonies about the grouse. When the MC introduced F.H., the boy took the stage and recounted the embarrassing story, breaking the audience up. From the time when he was 8 years old, young Frank went out spotlighting for deer with his paternal uncles Marley and Lewis. The men had a spotlight, built at the Herbert Brothers' shop, that was a swiveling car headlight hooked onto a 6-volt car battery. When a deer was located, the boy flipped on the light and pointed it at the deer, causing the animal to freeze, staring into the light. Then Marley or Lewis would fire their rifles. My father would recall later that there was no sport to it. They just went out and got meat for the family. On one daylight hunting trip with Uncle Marley, Marley suddenly stopped and pointed. Frank looked and saw a big buck with its forepaws on a tree. Marley didn't say a word or make a sound. He just passed the rifle to the boy and wagged his finger at the buck. Frank took careful aim and pulled the trigger. He hit the deer square in the chest, and it fell. Grandpa Otto had the biggest gun in the family, an 8-gauge shotgun brought over from Germany. A muzzle loader, it had been built by an independent craftsman under the old apprenticeship system, and was such a powerful, dangerous weapon that guns of its gauge would be outlawed a decade later in the United States. One day, Grandpa Otto said Frank could fire the gun and told him to shoot at an old rotten tree trunk. The boy understood the physics of recoil even at an early age and was afraid to put the gun against his shoulder. So he jammed the butt of the weapon against a sapling, aimed, and pulled the trigger. The roar was deafening. He blew a hell of a big hole in the rotten tree and cracked the sapling with the recoil of the butt. On other trips, Frank learned from logger Bill that it took less energy to step over a log than on it. I, in turn, would learn this lesson from my father many years later. On one hunting trip with Logger Bill and Uncle Marley, however, an exception to the rule presented itself. Logger Bill stepped over a log onto the back of a sleeping 6-point buck. The deer jumped and sent poor Logger Bill flying, with his gun coming out of his grasp. Some of Dad's trips into the woods were with his uncle Ade McCarthy, who, along with his brother Jack, had a secret spot where they dug for crystals and loaded them into knapsacks. The men had a thriving mail-order business selling crystals for crystal radios and other uses. His uncles were also involved in oyster farming, where young Frank learned to skin dive. In these and other ventures, he earned money to buy school clothes. When he was in his teens, he converted a rifle into a shotgun for bird hunting. He remained an avid hunter throughout most of his adulthood. Late in his life, however, he would develop the opinion that hunting was one of the myths of mankind, the myth that a man could hunt for all the meat his family needed. This was linked, in his view, to the larger myth of complete self-sufficiency, that a modern family could live entirely off the land, completely independent of stores, power companies, and money. Chapter 2. The Spanish Castle. On Frank Herbert's 9th birthday, only 3 weeks before the stock market crash of October 29, 1929, logger Bill Nerbon gave him a superb cedar rowboat he had made himself. With oak framing and spruce oars, it was 9 feet long, 1 foot for each of the boy's years. It rowed easily and became a constant source of joy for the young man. Christmas that year would be bleak for many families, as the nation reeled in the throes of economic collapse. Burley, with its many small subsistence farms, was something of an oasis from such troubles, and F.H.'s household was further insulated by the secure job he held with the state patrol. An adventurer, Frank was in the habit of taking his tiny rowboat on long trips, too far for a child of his age. In the summer of 1930, he made a solo trip from Burley all the way up Puget Sound to the San Juan Islands, a round-trip distance of more than 200 miles. He accomplished a large portion of this trip by rowing out into the shipping lanes and waiting for a tugboat pulling a barge, going in the direction he wanted to go. When the barge came near, he rowed at a furious pace and hitched himself onto it, often without being seen by the tugboat operator. Sometimes he was caught and cut loose. Other times the tugboat operators let him stay, and even slowed down so that he could hitch on or unhitch more easily. The boy came to know the schedules and routes of the barges so well that he was a regular, if non-paying, customer. He also made shorter trips by boat to the small town of Long Branch on the Key Peninsula, around 16 miles each way. When he was 10, my father took his rowboat out in Puget Sound and was fishing for cutthroat trout. It was at Horsehead Bay, near Long Branch, and he lost track of time. At dusk, he realized he couldn't get back in time to avoid a licking. Then he saw a fancy powerboat carrying people he knew, all of whom were whooping it up, having a merry time. Dad flagged them down, and they pulled alongside to assist. They tied his rowboat on and invited him aboard. After coming aboard, my father retied his boat properly and saw that the adults were drunk out of their minds. Someone asked Frank to pilot the boat back to Henderson Bay, which he did easily. He knew the waters well. The only accident occurred when they reached the dock. One of the inebriates fell in the water while trying to tie up the boat. In the spring of 1931, F.H. left his patrol duties and moved his little family to Highline, between Tacoma and Seattle. His ever-active mind was always coming up with money-making schemes, most of which didn't pan out. F.H., along with Babe and another couple, started a dance hall on Old Highway 99 known as the Spanish Castle. When construction began, my father ceremoniously turned the first spade of dirt. This was the Prohibition era, and the fledgling business, a 17,000-square-foot speakeasy serving alcohol illegally, was successful from the start. Babe worked in the ticket booth, while F.H., an intelligent, mechanically inclined man, made certain the lighting and other systems operated efficiently. F.H. worked on his own cars and maintained first-class personal shops wherever he lived. He was always coming up with inventions around the shop, tools and devices to make tasks easier. As money came in from dance hall profits, he purchased a Red Crown service station across the street, where he subsequently spent much of his time. Gasoline sold for 14 cents a gallon. Red, white, and blue banners were draped on either side of the fuel pump, and it had a glass top so that you could check the purity of the mixture as it ran through the machine. F.H. had an auto repair shop around back. As an incentive to customers, he offered free crankcase service. Babe was a strong, earthy woman, though barely 5 feet tall. With informal training as a nurse, she even delivered babies on occasion. One story in particular says a lot about her and F.H., and about the times in which they lived. When F.H. was still on the state patrol, she went on speakeasy raids with him, while her husband and other officers raided the illegal establishments and arrested scofflaws. She waited in the back seat of the patrol car, wearing a big fur coat. "When we pulled out of there," Babe recalled years later, "I tinkled with bottles under my coat." Young Frank often read past his bedtime, using a bare light bulb on the end of an extension cord under his bed covers to prevent casting light under the door. The bulb often browned the sheets. He was safe from scolding, though, since now his family could afford to have their laundry done outside the house, and his mother always blamed the laundry company and their mangle. But trouble was stirring between the dance hall partners. During their first year of operation, they got into a heated argument, in which my grandparents accused their partners of cheating them. In a huff, F.H. and Babe quit the business without compensation, then devoted their full attentions to the service station. Over the next 4 decades, the Spanish Castle became one of the most celebrated dance halls in the United States, visited by famous bands from all over, a situation that constantly rubbed salt into my grandparents' wounds.
Depressed when they saw what a huge mistake they had made, my grandparents began drinking more heavily than ever. This detracted from the operation of the service station, which was already struggling in the Great Depression.
Soon the business went bankrupt, and my grandparents lost everything. To make matters worse, Babe was pregnant. Without any source of income, F.H., Babe, and Frank, now 11, moved in with one of the McCarthy families in Tacoma. Frank, commonly called Junior,
for years, and ultimately into adulthood, my father was referred to as Junior, Frank Herbert Jr., by family members who knew both Franks, a moniker the younger loathed.
Shared a bedroom with two of his cousins, Thomas and Leonard McCarthy, and each night before they went to sleep, regaled them with adventure stories. The boys became like brothers. After 6 months, F.H. secured a job as a salesman. This enabled him to move the family to a beach home on Day Island, connected by a short bridge with the city of Tacoma. It was the spring of 1933. In May, Babe gave birth to a baby girl, Patricia Lou. After Dad's family moved to Tacoma, he visited Burley at every opportunity to see his grandparents and his old friend, Dan Laudholm. Early one morning, just across the channel from Day Island, Frank was fishing but not doing well. It was near Fox Point on Fox Island, where much of the shoreline was densely forested. After a while, he noticed a Native American man sitting on the shore, watching him intently. The man, in his late 40s, motioned the boy over and showed him how to make a herring dodger, which subsequently worked very well. Over the next 2 years, the man, Indian Henry, and my father became fast friends. Henry was a Ho, one of the Coast Salish, and lived by himself in an old smokehouse. He semi-adopted Frank, teaching him many of the ways of his people. This included how to catch fish with your feet, how to poach fish, and how to identify edible and medicinal plants in the forest. The Indian ate sweet red ants and found protein-rich grub worms under logs, which he also ate. The boy tasted ants and worms for the experience of it, but did not develop a taste for them. Henry also taught him how to catch a seagull by laying a slipknot tied with fishing line on the ground and placing a piece of herring inside. When the bird stepped into the circle of line, the noose was tightened, thus securing one or both of the gull's legs. In Soul Catcher, 1972, Frank Herbert would write of another hunting technique that he learned from Indian Henry. Katsuk had taken the grouse from a giant hemlock near the pond. He'd called it a roosting tree. The ground beneath it was white with grouse droppings. The grouse had come sleepily to the hemlock branches at dusk, and Katsuk had snared one with a long pole and a string noose. Though Indian Henry never admitted as much, his young Caucasian friend, tending toward the melodramatic, became convinced that he was a murderer who had been excommunicated from the tribe. The man hinted at something troublesome in his past, but the boy never obtained details and never felt at risk in his presence. 40 years later, Frank Herbert wrote about many of these experiences in his suspense-packed novel of Indian rage, Soul Catcher. After learning how to fish in the Indian way, young Frank always brought back big bunches of fish. Finally, a man who operated one of the general stores in Tacoma asked him how he did it. Naively, Frank showed him the dodger. After that, the man marketed identical dodgers in such volume that he made a tidy sum. To make extra money, my father put a 12-horsepower King outboard on his rowboat and used it to tow logs back to shore, where they could be cut into firewood and sold. One day he found a 20-by-20-by-10-foot, half-submerged container of fine Tennessee white oak, which he pulled in. Some of the wood was wormy, but the bulk of it was in good condition and of considerable value. By this time his family was on its economic feet again, so he got permission from his parents to barter the oak for a 27-foot sailboat that the owner didn't want, since it had a problem staying upright. By the time he was 15, Frank had the sailboat rebuilt and ballasted with concrete, which he poured into the hull. He took 14 people out sailing once, including a guitarist, a clarinetist, and an accordionist. In those days, my father told me, they called an accordion a squeeze-me-pull-me. On sailing trips, young Frank Herbert liked to sleep out on the deck. Stars lined the roof of the sky over his head, and he memorized the names and locations of constellations and major stars. He learned to use a sextant for navigation. When he was 14, he swam across the Tacoma Narrows, a mile through treacherous currents. A short while later, he and a 17-year-old friend, Ned Young, took a small Willett sailing canoe all the way to the fjords of the British Columbia mainland, just south of the Alaskan Panhandle, a round trip of nearly 2,000 miles. They turned the canoe over on beaches and slept under it. But when they got to the fjords, there weren't any beaches, so an Indian woman let them sleep on the porch of her little house and gave them breakfast. Through learning of my father's experiences in the outdoors, I've gained an insight into the thought processes that went into his writing. His great mainstream novel, Soul Catcher, about an Indian who could not accept the ways of white men, comes into clearer focus. He also wrote another Indian book, which was never published, Circle Times, a fictionalized but historically accurate account of the wars of the Coast Salish. My father admired the link between Native Americans and their environment, the way they lived for centuries in harmony with nature, not wreaking havoc upon it as the white man did. Frank Herbert developed a deep respect for the natural rhythms of nature. The ecology message, so prevalent in much of his writing, is one of his most important legacies. There is also an interesting, recurrent water and ocean theme in his writings, from his submarine novel The Dragon in the Sea, 1956, to The Sand Formations of Dune, 1965, that resemble slow-moving waves upon a great ocean. He was a sailor, fisherman, and swimmer, and would serve in the U.S. Navy during World War II. He understood the critical importance of potable water to a backwoodsman, hiker, and sailor. A tiny drop of water is the essence of all life. One of my father's earliest short stories, The Jonah and the Jap, 1946, concerns a seaplane that makes an emergency landing in the China Sea. In Try to Remember, 1961, aliens threatening Earth arrive in an immense spaceship that resembles a tiny freshwater organism with cilia. The Mary Celeste Move, 1964, describes a phenomenon in which people abruptly leave their homes and move far away, often leaving their belongings behind. An idea based upon the mysterious sailing ship Mary Celeste, found floating in 1872 with its passengers and crew missing. The Primitives, 1966, describes a man named Swimmer who is adept at underwater criminal activities. The Mind Bomb, 1969, takes place in an oceanside town. Seedstock, 1970, concerns a world with a purple ocean where the primary food source is a creature like a shrimp. Songs of a Sentient Flute, with Bill Ransom, 1979. Like their collaborative novels The Jesus Incident, 1979, and The Lazarus Effect, 1983, involve ocean worlds covered with vast, sentient kelp formations. As a young man, Frank Herbert was close to his grandmother, Mary Ellen Herbert, a kindly, thin woman with a long face and large round eyeglasses. She favored long dresses with flower prints and usually wore an apron, even when away from home. Mary usually tied her gray hair in a bun, and it had a beautiful sheen from shampooing with secret ingredients. Some folks in Burleigh thought it was a concoction of beer and eggs, while others said it was whiskey and olive oil. Mary just laughed at all the guesses. Though an illiterate countrywoman, she was a genius with figures, and no matter how big the numbers were that anyone wanted her to add, subtract, multiply, or divide, she always got the answers right. She instilled a love of math in her favorite grandson, which he employed in his science fiction writings. She also had an incredible memory and recalled details perfectly from decades before. Mary Herbert was, in effect, a human computer, and she became a model for the Mentats of Dune. A renowned quilt maker, Grandma Herbert won so many awards at the big county fair in Burleigh that the fair committee finally banned her from competing. Nonetheless, she continued to make quilts, and they were displayed prominently each year at the fair. Every quilt had an interesting story, something to do with the history of the Herbert family, which she related to young Frank. One year, she sent a beautiful blue eagle quilt to President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his wife Eleanor, commemorating their wedding anniversary. Beginning when Dad was around 10 years old, he used to go over to Mary's house and read old family letters to her, which she kept in a trunk. Some of the letters were valuable, as they had 18th-century New England postmarks on them, even several rare Boston postmarkings, so the boy handled them carefully. During moments of excitement, Grandma Herbert would lapse into Old English, a dialect spoken in her family for centuries. Sometime in the 1600s, her ancestors had immigrated to the hills of Kentucky and Tennessee, and in certain enclaves, the old dialects were preserved and spoken. Upon hearing these strange words, the young Frank Herbert was fascinated. Ultimately, he conducted extensive research into languages and dialects, information he used to great effect in Dune and other works. My father remembered how Mary used to take out posters of his great-uncle Frank Herbert, Otto's younger brother, who had been the circus and vaudeville star Professor Herbert. She would fold open each poster carefully, saying, "This is your great-uncle Frank. You and your father were named for him." Mary Herbert also had a red leather-bound genealogy book showing that our family was directly descended from Henry VIII, King of England, but on the wrong side of the sheets. Henry used to frequent a public house run by a woman named Moll Golden, a place where he drank and sang. Moll had 6 illegitimate children, all presumably fathered by Henry. She was an exceptional singer, and it was said that she took on the name Golden because of her voice. Henry had his own musical talents, as he sang with her and played the lute. He may even have written the tune Greensleeves for her. Before the age of 12, Frank, ever curious, read the complete works of Shakespeare and discovered the poetry of Ezra Pound. With these readings, the boy began to realize the potential of the English language. He fell in love with the sounds of words. In other literature, he discovered Guy de Maupassant and Marcel Proust, and had what he called love affairs with them. He admired the styles of both, and was intrigued by de Maupassant's plotting techniques and Proust's powerful characterizations. Something Ezra Pound once said remained with my father all his life, and was quoted frequently by him. "Make it new." To Dad, Pound was more than a poet. He was a non-conforming creative writer and an ongoing inspiration. In his early teens, Frank was for a time infatuated with the writings of Ernest Hemingway. Eventually, however, he came away with a sense that Hemingway's work was phony and filled with unnecessary brutality. Of all the writers my father read in his youth, he was perhaps most obviously influenced by Shakespeare. In Dune's palaces, with their great banquet halls and dark passageways, one gets a very similar feeling to the castles in which Shakespeare's characters brooded and schemed and murdered. Treason and treachery permeate the writings of Shakespeare. When in Dune, Frank Herbert wrote of tricks within tricks within tricks, and treachery within treachery within treachery, and plans within plans within plans within plans. His language was reminiscent of Richard II, Act 2, Scene 3, Line 87. "Grace me no grace, nor uncle me no uncle." Director David Lynch later picked up the Shakespearean mood in his 1984 movie adaptation of Dune. Throughout his youth, Frank Herbert was a voracious reader on every imaginable subject. At age 11, he used to go alone to visit Dr. Jimmy Egan in Tacoma, their family practitioner. Frank was intrigued by his anatomy books, which the doctor let him peruse. Subsequently, Frank was able to tell his schoolmates how babies were conceived and born. Whenever his schoolmates had a question about sex, someone invariably said, "Let's ask Herbert. He'll know." But one little girl told her mother what was occurring. Enraged, the woman stormed over to Frank's house and confronted his mother, Babe. From the kitchen, the boy eavesdropped. The woman was so upset she could hardly speak. After getting the gist of what the woman was saying, Babe asked calmly, "Well, did he misinform her?" Sputtering, the woman said, "No, but..." "Then what are you complaining about?" Babe wanted to know. It went on like this, with Babe defending her son, to the point where the woman could hardly get a word in edgewise. Exasperated, she finally gave up the effort and left. By then, Frank was in the kitchen making a sandwich and hardly looked up when his mother came in. Suddenly, she grabbed him by the ear and whirled him around. "Explain yourself," she said. At 14, Frank learned to type and saved enough money to buy his own typewriter, a big, heavy old Remington. On it, he hammered out his stories and a long humorous poem describing Christmas and one of his father's jobs. He began copying the styles of writers he liked, such as Guy de Maupassant and Herman Melville, searching for his own style, something comfortable. One day my father went for advice to a writer living in Tacoma who had sold a couple of novels and several short stories. The response? "Work like hell, kid." Chapter 3. Cub Reporter. F.H. and Babe disciplined their extremely active son erratically. At times they brought down a heavy hammer of authority on him, but on other occasions, especially when they were incapacitated by alcohol, it was exactly the opposite, and they let him run free. For the most part, he went wherever he pleased, whenever he pleased. As the years went by, F.H. and Babe drank more and more to forget their business misadventures. Following a stint as a salesman, F.H. became a security guard for Northern Pacific Railroad, and after that, in 1935, a deputy sheriff for Pierce County, Washington. Many of his closest friends were on the police forces of various jurisdictions, including the State Highway Patrol where he had once worked. This did not curb the drinking. In recalling the free-to-roam lifestyle of his childhood, my father described himself as having been a punk kid. Perhaps he was, but if so, he retained redeeming qualities, and it was only one dimension of a complex, developing personality. On a number of occasions, his lifestyle led him into dangerous activities, such as the long and perilous boat excursions he took, and hunting trips taken without adult supervision. Once, he nearly drowned in a tricky current while swimming off a sandbar in Tacoma's Hylabos waterway. His school studies were always easy for him, and frequently he became bored in class. In elementary school, he used to shoot spitballs at insects on the walls of the classroom, at his classmates, and at his fourth-grade teacher, Mrs. Pastor. While standing at the blackboard with her back to the class, she felt something wet hit the back of her neck. No one told Mrs. Pastor who did it, not in so many words, but when she pulled the tiny wad of wet tissue off her neck and whirled around, all eyes turned toward the tow-headed Frank, who sat in the middle of the class near the front. She marched to his desk and plopped the spitball in front of him. A tall woman with thick glasses and her hair tied in a bun, she towered over him. "See, you're the one," she snapped, her face wrinkled in anger. "Stay after school, boy, and I'll deal with you." "I'm in for it," my father thought, as she returned to the blackboard. His mind filled with a thousand terrors, and for the rest of the day, he could think of little else. After school, he sat at a little chair by her desk, looking up fearfully into the reflective glare of her glasses, searching for a way to calm her. She glared down at him, her face a glistening, explosive mask of fury. "Why are you so mad at me?" Frank asked, his voice small and breaking. "I'm not mad at you," she bellowed, and she grabbed him by his shoulders and shook him violently, and shook him, screaming all the while, "I'm not mad at you. I'm not mad at you." It was a bizarre scene, and years afterward, when he had time to reflect upon the event, he became aware of unconscious behavior. His teacher had been angry at him without knowing it herself. He would use this facet of psychology in his writings and in his life with great success. He would watch what people were doing, not what they were saying. When he was 16, he took the family Buick out on a date with permission from his father. He had a girlfriend and two other couples in the car and roared along Highway 99 outside Tacoma at more than 80 miles an hour. Presently, a state motorcycle cop pulled him over, got off his bike, and walked to the driver's side. "You," the patrolman exclaimed, looking in the window. It was Bernie Rausch, a good friend of the family. Rausch often visited the Herbert household at Dash Point, just north of Tacoma. He told Dad to follow him, and with his motorcycle led the offender straight home. While Frank waited in the car for what seemed like an eternity, Rausch spoke at the doorway with F.H. Presently, the old man took the car keys and told Frank to wait in the house. F.H. drove the friends home, while Frank suffered, wondering what his punishment would be. He didn't get a beating that time, but was grounded for 2 months and prohibited from using the car. Extra chores were assigned, too, and the young man had to chop several cords of firewood. Frank Herbert's sister, Patricia Lou, almost 13 years his junior, became an increasing source of concern for him. Their parents were on the brink of divorce, arguing constantly and drinking more than ever. Too often, she was neglected. The boy took care of her when he could. On many occasions, he bought baby food and other necessities with his own odd job earnings. He also purchased toys for her, or made them of wood and whatever else he could find. The family was living in South Tacoma at the time. He went to nearby Stewart Intermediate School, graduating in June 1935 with a grade point average of only 1.93. The following September, He enrolled at Lincoln High School, only a few blocks from his home. He failed Latin in his first semester, but on retaking the class in the spring of 1936, earned a B. Then in a subsequent attempt to take more advanced Latin during the spring of 1937, he dropped out of the class, receiving no grade. The only other class he failed, also in the spring 1937 semester, was geometry. In other geometry classes, he received C's each time. In English, where he would one day write prose read by millions, he had two B's, a C, and a D. He received his only A in the fall 1936 semester in world history. His grade point average for the first 2.5 years was a meager 2.05. When he began his senior year in the fall of 1937, he was behind in the credits needed for graduation, so he took one extra class and passed everything with slightly better than a C average. He took a journalism class that semester, receiving a B. As part of this class, he was on the staff of the Lincoln News, a high school newspaper that was run according to professional standards by Homer Post, an ex-reporter and educational legend. The paper was a perennial national award winner. Frank Herbert, who would later spend many years in the newspaper profession, was 16 when he began the journalism class and turned 17 during it, an impressionable time of life in which to fall under the influence of a master. Earlier, my father had been influenced by an ex-newspaper man living in Burley, Henry W. Stein, who regaled him with tales of life on a big city newspaper. Working out of the school news shack under Post's tutelage, Frank became a general assignment news chaser, a reporter doing school and community stories. It was like a real newspaper, and he learned the importance of deadlines, how to copy edit, and how to find the most interesting angle on a story. He often wore a blue serge suit, a light tan shirt, and a tie to his classes. Rather neat, though inexpensive attire for high school. By all accounts, Frank Herbert was well-liked on campus, a young man with a buoyant attitude and boundless energy. Another student remembered how blonde he was, and his pink-and-white, peaches-and-cream complexion. One day he burst in the door of the news shack and shouted, "Stop the presses! I've got a scoop!" In the spring of 1938, Dad took two extra classes, still trying to catch up on the credits he was behind. This workload, combined with problems he was experiencing at home, proved too much for him. In May 1938, he dropped all of the classes, earning no credits for that semester. Among the classes he dropped were journalism and public speaking, areas in which he would excel in later years. In the summer, he earned extra money working for a newspaper, the Tacoma Ledger. He performed copy boy and other office duties, and was sent on some reporting assignments when the regular reporters were on vacation. The following semester, in the fall of 1938, he took a normal class load, including journalism. All that year, he excelled on the school newspaper. A number of feature stories appeared under his byline, and he wrote a regular column on page 2 called Riding the Rail, in which he discussed school events, often humorously. His columns were high in political content, reflecting his knowledge of world affairs, a knowledge that was enhanced by his participation in the school debating team where he starred. The debating experience whetted his appetite for politics, an area of interest that would remain with him for the rest of his life. He was promoted to associate editor of the paper. In the 1930s, there was a great deal of interest in ESP, extrasensory perception, particularly in Rhine consciousness, the term for paranormal experiments with cards conducted by Dr. Joseph Banks Rhine of Duke University. He conducted experiments in which subjects were asked to guess what card another person was holding when the backside was only visible to the subject. The results seemed to prove the existence of ESP. One evening, Dad was on a date with a girl named Patty, and they tried their own version of the Rhine experiments, using a standard deck of 52 playing cards. One by one, she held cards up, and my father guessed all of them correctly. Thinking he was tricking her, she obtained another deck of cards and took great care to mix them up and conceal them from him. Again, he guessed each card correctly. Later, under different circumstances, Dad found himself unable to repeat the astounding results. This experience of my father's became the basis of his short story, Encounter in a Lonely Place, published in 1973. A strong occult theme ran through a number of his most important works as well, including the Dune series and Soul Catcher. When he was 17, Frank Herbert analyzed the Western fiction market by reading several boxes of books and magazines he had purchased at a used bookstore. A formula became apparent to him, and he used it to write a Western story under a pseudonym. It sold to Street and Smith for $27.50, and he was elated. Confident that he had discovered a path to instant success as a writer, he spent the money quickly. Then, in only a few weeks, he wrote 24 more stories, all using the identical formula. Rejection letters poured in. He would not make another sale for 8 years. My father never revealed the title of that first story sale or the pseudonym under which he wrote it. Not particularly proud of the writing, he said it was amateurish. Nonetheless, it was a sale, and he was still in high school at the time. Displaying literary versatility and a curiosity about what lay before him on the uncharted course of life, he wrote a poem entitled Your Life, published in the September 30th, 1938 issue of the Lincoln News. What is the meaning of your life? If you live close to nature, is it hidden in a towering tree, a busy worker bee, a flower in bloom, the sun piercing the morning's gloom? Or do you live in civilization? Does fancy people your imagination with thoughts of laborers, soot and grime, youths leading lives of crime, long hours and payday, nightlife in its heyday? Or are you but chaff from the great miller's gleaning? Or wherever you live, does your life have a meaning? Only 2 months later, his home life would fall apart entirely. He could no longer stand the suffering of his sister, now 5, so again he dropped all of his classes, earning no credits toward graduation. With his parents drinking heavily and near divorce, he ran away from home, taking Patricia Liu with him. The pair caught a bus to Salem, Oregon, and sought refuge with Frank's favorite aunt, Peggy Violet Roundtree, and her husband, Ken Roundtree Sr. Peggy was one of Babe's sisters. Within